and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, senior fellow here at Bruegel, joined by Zsolt Darvas, our senior fellow who specializes in macroeconomics and budget sorts of things. We are so delighted today to be joined by Jennifer Shuba, the director of the Population Reference Bureau. She's coming to us from Washington, D.C. We are going to be talking about the demographic challenges facing the EU and, to some extent, the rest of the world, and how we are going to pay for the social services that they require as these populations get older. Zsolt, you have a new paper out that I know has been of great interest in the policy and political community. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
We very often focus on what fiscal policy should do in the next few years. But in this paper, we take a much longer-term view. We look up to 2052, so almost three decades ahead, and looked at what kind of implications European demographic changes have for Eurozone or EU country budgets. Perhaps everybody knows that the European population is aging very rapidly. The number of working age population is set to shrink from 264 million to only 207 million. A 21% decline over the next three decades. So there is a very dramatic change in working age people in the absence of immigration. At the same time, the number and also the share of elderly people go up and the number of children goes down. And certainly, I mean, a much higher number of elderly people will have to be supported by a much smaller number of workers. And this indeed creates major challenges for European budgets and the sustainability of public finances. So what we did is that we applied European Union fiscal rules up to 2052, and we looked at how much fiscal adjustments European countries will have to make to comply with these rules. And our finding is that since the fiscal rules have a built-in component of aging, in a sense that, by the way, fiscal adjustment is determined, considers how the future development of aging costs is going to happen, then in principle, EU countries might be enough to do a fiscal adjustment in the first adjustment period, in the next few years, and that might be enough. However, there is a big however, and this is the main result from our paper. So if you look at the rising cost of aging, this means that, I mean, the countries will have to devote a much larger share of their budgets for paying for pensions and healthcare and old age care. It will mean that they can pay much less on everything else, including public administration or police or schools or whatever. And we indeed find that if you take this into account, then fiscal adjustment is not enough in the first adjustment period in the next 4 to 7 years, but it has to continue in every subsequent adjustment period up to 2052. And the overall magnitude of adjustment would be pretty large and clearly unprecedented for many European Union countries. So the outlook is very, very bleak. And the options, you know, one option is to improve the demographic outlook. I mean, there are some, I would say, easier options, like trying to foster those people to work who currently don't work. For example, encouraging inactive young people to join the labor market, or limiting early retirement and encourage people to work longer in their lives, and so on. Another option is, of course, boosting fertility or supporting fertility, but it's very, very difficult. Another option is to try to increase GDP and economic growth. Everybody would like to do that. It's very easy to say, much more difficult to do. A third option is reducing aging costs. For example, reducing pensions, politically very, very difficult. And also healthcare costs. Reducing healthcare costs is absolutely difficult. Or perhaps there is a last option, changing European Union fiscal rules, which is, again, not a easy one, since the fiscal rules has just been changed this year, so nobody would like to talk about it anymore. So overall, our results suggest a rather pessimistic outlook for the next decades in terms of fiscal policy and aging.
So fiscal adjustment in this case means either taxing more, cutting services, or borrowing more in capital markets? Are those our big choices?
So the choices are indeed taxing more or reducing all kind of expenditures, you know, building less bridges, providing less for the police, switching off street lighting when it's late in the night and things like that.
Jennifer, how reliable are these kinds of predictions? For those of us who don't work with this every day, is this more like weather where your predictions are really only good in the short term? Or is this something like continental drift where you can really sort of look at it over a long period of time?
I don't think it's either of those things. I think it is a scenario that tells you what you need to do in the present to make the kind of future you want. And I think it's the same for demographic projections. It's not about saying, here's what's going to happen in the future, no matter what. It's about laying out a pathway towards the future. So it's, if you don't do X, Y, Z, then this is what's likely to happen. So if you don't like what's likely to happen, you need to be making adjustments in the nearer term.
What kinds of adjustments are possible? Is it possible to change your demographics?
It's certainly possible to change your demographics when it comes to immigration. And if we're in a very zoomed out world, it's possible to think about, it's possible to change your demographics when it comes to longevity as well. We've seen tremendous gains in that in the last half century. I don't think that we should be talking about raising fertility as in that realm of possibility, however, because I think it distracts us from doing the harder work. I think it's politically easier to talk about raising fertility than any of the other policy options that were just laid out, because there are people on both the political left and the political right who can kind of get on board with the suite of policies that we recommend, that they would recommend around raising fertility. So if you're on the political right, we might use more rhetoric around the family, supporting the family. If you're on the political left, you might think much more about generous policies around leave or childcare. This is true, you know, around the world. So that one is palatable, but raising pension ages or asking people to work longer or doing much harder structural reforms, those are politically infeasible. And so, but they're actually the ones that we need to focus on because, of course, as we all know, those policies to raise fertility, they may have lots of great outcomes, such as making it easier for families to raise children, but they're not necessarily going to change the dial on demographics.
That's really a helpful way to look at it. How does Europe's situation compare to Asia and to the U.S. and some of the other developed economies that it's economically working with?
There are a few things that would stand out about Europe and a few things that are pretty common. So let's go with the common first. It is a global trend to have lower fertility rates. We've gone from very high to lower. The global rate of population growth has been declining since the 1960s. And we've reached a world where the average number of children born per woman is just barely over what we would call replacement rate. And of course, that's easy to think about. Think about, you know, two parents. So replacement rate is roughly around two. Global fertility rate is around 2.2 or 2.3 today. So we can see this as part of a bigger trend. Europe, of course, is a region with sub-replacement fertility. So we're even further along that, but two out of three people in the world live somewhere with sub-replacement fertility. So again, kind of in line with that. If we're starting to look at that group of countries with sub-replacement fertility, you see big variety within Europe. There are some countries where fertility rates are much lower, and there's also a lot of out-migration, so there's rapidly shrinking populations. Like, think more about the East. And in East Asia, the total fertility rate is just really over one child per woman. So again, we've got countries that are shrinking. But also within Europe, you've got countries that low-fertility countries wish that they looked like. You'd have fertility rates closer to the 1.6 or 1.7, like a Sweden or a France. And the United States, so you can go, now we look at North America as being comparable there, also with immigration to supplement growth of the working age population. So in that sense, there are somewhat commonalities, but a little bit of divergence there. I think where we can start to talk more about divergence is in the rules around work and retirement and the cultures and norms around work and retirement that I think will lead to really different outcomes when it comes to population aging.
Joel, do you take on the retirement age in your paper? European countries have retirement ages anywhere between 60 and 67, I guess, is where most of them top out. Is there any effort to standardize or harmonize that?
It's a national competence, and the EU doesn't have a direct role in influencing that. Nevertheless, the European Commission regularly reviews countries' policies with the view of the sustainability of pension systems. And in Europe, we have a policy coordination instrument, which is called European Semester, which leads in every year so-called country-specific recommendations. And these recommendations very often include recommendations related to the sustainability of pension systems. It's not obligatory for the countries to do them, to follow these recommendations. In contrast, for example, the European fiscal rules have very strong legal basis, and if countries don't follow fiscal rules, they might face fines. These recommendations are more in line with broad economic outlines and policy control. Nevertheless, the Commission makes quite a number of such recommendations, which are endorsed by the Council. And these are related, for example, linking the retirement age to life expectancy, or harmonizing within country the different pension schemes which apply to different segments of the society, limiting options for early retirement, encouraging people to work longer than the statutory retirement age. So there are lots of efforts by European institutions to try to advise countries on how to make their pension system sustainable. However, when we look at the implementation, that's very, very poor. So the European Commission regularly monitors how countries implement those recommendations. And in particular on pension reform, the typical assessment is limited progress. But very often no progress is also graded by the European Commission. So countries don't really like to get advice on how to make their pension system sustainable, which I think is a bit of a shame, because, again, when there is no aim to harmonize across Europe, I think there's a lot of knowledge and a lot of best practices in different countries, from which countries which face the most difficult outlook in terms of their pension systems could learn a lot.
For the next part of our podcast, I'd like to talk some more about those best practices. Jennifer, is there anything you see in terms of how countries prepare to meet these challenges that seems to work?
I think generally speaking, they're doing very little to prepare to meet these challenges. Right now, those that are maybe weathering the storm a bit better might have started with some advantages. I'm not sure that we could say, though, that they were intentional. And that's where we need to move, is towards the intention around it. So maybe there's three areas to look at there. So we've got lifespan, health span, and work span. If we break it down that way, we need to have longer lifespans. We need to have longer health spans and longer work spans, because you can't just have a longer lifespan and leave the others behind, which I think is, you know, kind of what you're saying in the paper as well. In Asia, let's just think about Japan and South Korea, for example. Especially a few years ago, pre-pandemic, the average age of exit from the workforce, or the effective retirement age, was getting closer around 70 or 71. There was a time I saw that it was 71 in Japan. And certainly that means that there are millions more, if not tens of millions more, older people in the workforce. That is a wonderful adaptation to population aging. Those who are able to work longer physically and are able to work longer legally, there's a piece to come back to, can certainly do so. In the United States, we are really struggling on our health span. So, you know, even if we might have rules in place that would allow people to work longer, let's say that there are not disincentives to working longer in terms of being able to get pensions, or if maybe there's not mandatory retirement, health span is bad here. So people are not physically able to work longer, which is terrible when it comes to adjusting to population aging and being resilient. Now, in Europe, health span's pretty good. in many places at least. And the problem is, of course, that the work span is much shorter. And so being able to adjust that upward really will matter, because you're talking about, just people between the ages of 65 and 74. Look at this worldwide, and there are, over 500 million people of those ages, while there are only 300 million migrants globally. So we're talking about really big groups of people that, if they were more engaged in the workforce, could make a huge difference potentially on the economy.
Do you see a way forward, maybe raising the retirement age, but also making more disability provisions available for people who aren't able to keep working? Is that one way to get through it?
It's been many years since I studied disability provisions, but the last I did, there were a lot of them in place. And in fact, that's often why the effective retirement age would be lower than the actual retirement age in some places, that there were always these alternative ways to exit the workforce. So actually, again, it's been years since I studied this, but I remember the conclusions of my research years ago was, don't worry about overall retirement age. Politically, it's the third rail. Instead, if you'll actually look at some of these alternative ways that people exit the workforce, they're a little bit sneakier to deal with politically, because it's you don't realize what, the effect of them will be, but you can actually help people stay in the workforce longer. Now, that's not to say, oh, let's try to force everyone to work who's suffering from a disability and unable to do so. But it's about looking at the entire suite of policies around retirement besides official retirement age. I mean, low-hanging fruit in some settings is getting rid of mandatory retirement. I'm always surprised to see how much that is still on the books. There's just this general sense of inflexibility around the end of working life. And that's where I would start, because again, it's more politically palatable. Do your laws and norms allow for people to walk back their work commitments towards the end of their working career? Can you go part-time? Can you come on as a consultant? Or are there rules in place that might have originally been there to protect you from abuse, but now you sure would like to be able to use them?
That's really interesting, Jennifer, because we have a situation where some of these early retirement ages were put in place because people were physically unable to keep working. Now there's a great deal of inequality in the workforce, in that some people in harder jobs are still sort of finding that their bodies are worn out earlier, while other people are able to keep working, and as you just said, may not have the option to do so. Jolt, do you have any thoughts on how this could fit into the way that Europe approaches this issue? Like, you've got this giant fiscal adjustment that has to be made. What if you could just keep the workers in? Is there a way to think about best practices, or just to put some numbers on the table saying this is how much it costs you if you let everybody, if you give everyone the option to retire at 60? Like, what's our universe of thoughts here?
So let me start by citing some good news. If you look at the employment share of people between 55 and 74, so it includes, let's say, almost the last 10 years before retirement and plus 10 more years, then on average in the EU, it has increased to just a little bit over 15% to almost 40% over the past 20 years. So already the process has started. And more some elderly people are kept in the labor force, and they keep working, which is good news.
So this is 40% of the labor force, not just of the population.
So 40% of that segment of the population, so 40% of the 55, 74 years old in Europe, they are currently working.
All right.
Now, there are also projections. I mean, the EU has lots of projections which suggest that this ratio might increase somewhat further into the future. Again, and Jennifer discussed earlier the reliability of various projections. So it's certainly it can't go to 90%. As you know, the prime age labor force participation rate, let's say for Sweden, but I think there is still a major scope for an increase there. And indeed, what is crucial is that people not just should live longer, but they should have a healthier life, living longer. But if they have that, then it will be basically a political, I would say, choice to try to convince those people that, look, I mean, you are going to live, I would say 30 more years than your grandparents lived, and most of these additional 30 years will be spent in good health. So, I mean, try to make use of yourself and try to contribute to the society and the economy.
Do you think the EU needs a broader base of pension savings? I mean, traditionally it's been very much from the public sector. We have the Draghi report, which just came out, suggesting that there should be a lot more focus on occupational pensions. Where do you see this headed?
The private pensions are very heterogeneous within the European Union. There are some countries like, you know, Netherlands and Denmark, where people already accumulated very large private pension savings. And indeed, in those countries, also for this reason, the public pension system is much more sustainable than in others. So in general, you know, the answer is yes. Improving the private pillar of the pension system is beneficial. Again, it takes times, decades, if not more, to build up sufficient private pensions. But yes, this is an important way to go.
As we head into the last section of our podcast, I'd love to hear from both of you what you'd like policymakers to be doing besides just sort of wringing their hands and saying, wow, well, this is hard. We don't want to make any massive cuts, and we don't have any, you know, immediate ways to change the trend. Maybe we're just stuck. Like, what can they be doing to make a difference?
I'd like to see them stop focusing on big policies. Actually, I think those are the ones that are really tough politically. If we start disaggregating, we can see it's a much easier path forward. So you very rightly mentioned inequality. If we were talking about, if we have this big goal of people working longer, and we do not open up to talk about what are the differences among people, and this is the case, it doesn't matter if we're talking within Europe or even outside Europe, there are always going to be people who, given the types of jobs that they had, or their own personal circumstances, are not able to work longer. So the problem with a let's get people to work longer approach to this is that it could exacerbate that inequality, and it's really hard. So how about saying, let's change rules for people who want to work longer and are able to do so, to help them be able to do so? There's a lot, I think, of low-hanging fruit around this issue that we have yet to pick. It's this focus on changing everything overall. And I see it not just talking about pensions or retirement. I see it also in terms of fertility policy. And I do keep trying to change the conversation away from supranational or national policy to much smaller levels of policymaking, where even at the company level, where we can see big shifts.
Incremental policymaking. That's the European way. Jolt, should we get excited now that this is doable?
My number one recommendation would be, you know, much more focus on the medium term, because, you know, whenever a new government comes to power, you know, their main interest is to be reelected in the next 4 years. And certainly pensioners, for example, is a major group of voters. Also, there are lots of other interest groups. So any government who seeks reelection, it's very, very hard and very difficult to make politically do some hard choices which improve long-term sustainability but might face resistance from certain interest groups. But still, I think there are things to do, even, for example, just for fiscal policy. I mean, it's also quite clear that, for example, if labor is heavily taxed, then, you know, people might say, okay, why should I work, you know, 2 or 3 more years after retirement if, you know, a large share of my income, you know, would anyway be taxed away. So again, I think, for example, good tax incentives, for as Jennifer said, for people who would like to work longer, but somehow either due to regulations or due to a high tax burden, which I see, unfortunately both are prevalent in Europe. Again, this is something which could be done, and certainly that wouldn't face such a resistance, because if you increase the statutory pension age, many people will complain. You know, if you cut taxes on the labor income of elderly people, nobody will complain. But in fact, many people will be much, much happier and ready to work longer.
It's a really interesting idea because I think we've all met people who work maybe on the black markets. They don't have to earn money that could cut into the pension benefits they raise. Maybe there's a way to reconcile that. Is there anything specific to Europe you think that could be a lesson to other parts of the world in terms of managing all of this? Because we've been talking to this episode about how all countries are facing this trend of growing older populations and how to pay for the benefits and maintain services without the kind of 20th century idea that you always had more people in the workforce than older on the other end of it.
So European fiscal rules include a very important and useful provision in this regard, because the way fiscal adjustment is calculated looks 10 years beyond the end of the fiscal adjustment and look at how demography and aging costs are expected to change. And for countries which have, you know, rising aging costs, again, 10 years after the fiscal adjustment, they have to do a fiscal adjustment now to make room that they will be able to pay for those extra costs 10 years later. And this creates a very strong incentives for countries to, again, to do those very hard reforms, because, you know, if they can improve the medium-term outlook for the pension system, then they can already reduce how much painful fiscal adjustment they have to do next year. And again, we all know that that's also a politically very, very difficult thing to do for a government, to cut expenditures or raise taxes.
Saving for a rainy day is always useful and always hard to do. Jennifer, are there any global efforts to make this look more fun or more approachable for governments out there that you'd like to bring our attention to?
I think we're the ones who will have to lead it. I don't think so. I find that overall, they're just still trying to put the genie back in the bottle, so to speak. It's all the focus is on how to change the demographics, with some technocratic people thinking ahead about balances between workforce and, you know, entitlements. But I don't think that it's taken seriously that this is a permanent shift. I think that's the difference, is there's still some wonder about, well, fertility rates can't possibly stay this low, can they? They certainly wouldn't go lower, would they? We certainly need to change this to be better off in the long run, don't we? And if we could just have this first step of people accepting this as a reality, I actually think it would open up a lot of other avenues of policymaking in adjusting to that reality.
Schultz, any closing thoughts? Anything you want to come back to or that you think we haven't gotten to yet?
We spoke relatively little about immigration, but obviously that's another source for the host country to address the challenges that aging and declining populations pose. But it's also a politically very decisive issue. Now, again, for immigration, people understand very different things, because certainly there is an irregular immigration or the inflow of refugees who need humanitarian support. But it takes quite a long time until those people will be able to join the labor market. On the other hand, even countries which seem to be relatively adverse to immigration still invite, you know, qualified labor, because there are major labor shortages everywhere in Europe and I guess in also many other parts of the world. So one additional avenue would be somehow to explore better ways for attracting qualified labor. But it's, you know, it's a double-edged sword, because it's good for Europe, but it's very bad for the source countries, from where this qualified labor would leave. So that also, I would say, some global justice issues, you know, whether these rich nations in Europe and elsewhere should really attract the talented people from poorer parts of the world.
The balance between skilled immigration and movement of migrants who don't yet have skills but might in the future, or their kids might have in the future, is such a political hot button right now. Do you think that the tensions over migration from outside the EU will cool down anytime soon?
I'm afraid not. Also, if you just look at, you know, the impact of climate change, I'm afraid the number of people moving is set to increase.
And what about, I have to ask this because it's been in the news, what about the strains on the Schengen free movement system? We see many countries now wanting to make it harder to move across borders, which presumably could hurt people who commute as well as all of the other people who are traveling around.
So I'm less worried about the Schengen system because that provides free movement for workers within mostly European countries, not all, but also there are some countries outside Europe. But even within Europe, you know, rules don't allow you to move to another country for long if you don't work or don't have health insurance from other sources. So I think that system within Europe is working well. Now, what is indeed the question, I think, in current political debates is much more related to illegal immigration. So whenever illegal immigrants somehow are able to enter a country, whether they can move freely to other parts of Europe and what problems they cause. But I think it's a somewhat different problem from the long-term demographic challenges that Europe faces.
It's such a complicated situation. Jennifer, any closing thoughts for today's discussion?
I would just expect that the politics over all of these issues, whether pensions or immigration or fertility, will continue to be pretty prominent for the next several years, if not decades. So certainly this is an issue that we'll keep coming back to. And my big hope is that we just see some movement in the debate towards more actionable solutions.
Thank you very much, Jennifer Shuba, Director of the Population Reference Bureau. Really appreciate your joining us today. Learned a lot. We also have Jolt Darvest. Always great to have you on the program. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, here at Bruegel, speaking, of course, in my personal capacity. And you can find Jolt's report on our website, Bruegel.org, along with all of our other podcasts and research reports. And we will also link to Jennifer's organization in there. Research landing page. So stick around. Thanks for joining us, and we hope to see you next time. Bye-bye.